Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul France, owner of France Games. I've been SFA Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just my name is joined by the talk guest every Thursday starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone to dial 605-562-0444, just follow the directions, call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web, just go to the Walk Talkshow website at www.talkshow.com. Search for call ID 17702. Or SFU on call or Starfleet Universe on call, and you will find us there. But if you want the best experience when it comes to being online, that would be twitch.tv. Yes, I said twitch.tv. Go to twitch.tv/SFU on call, and you will find us there. You'll be able to join the chat room and join the wonderful chat and be part of the whole community. So please join us there. If you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. It's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to follow me on the Twitters, it still exists, you can follow me on sfuoncall there. Also, if you want to, you can follow me my personal account, which is Paul Franz, PaulFranz. There is no T. And of course, if you want to follow my business account, which is Franz Games, that's FranzGames, again, no T. And you can follow me there and just find out what's going on with Starfleet Universe on call. And also, of course, some FedCom Online and Starfleet Warlord. And if you, of course, this lovely TalkCast gets into podcasts available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Just some quick news from ADB this week, which is there is no news. It's been all quiet there. And I don't think Steve has posted anything when it comes to the blog. But the ongoing series of Found in the Online Store is the F&E Jumbo Aux 80 Counter Pack. It's only 80 counters, so it's not a lot. But, you know, of course, just if you want to buy multiple copies and you know, just add them up, you know. And those, it's only for $3 for 80 counters. And these are the heavy and jumbo ships for the Federation, the Klingons, the Romulans, the Zinnies, the Lirans, the Hydras, ISC, Gorns, LDR, and of course the generics. Just a reminder, of course, ADB has lots of free stuff on their website. Just go to starfleetgames.com. I would just go right into the Master Index, and you'll find it there, and you'll find all kinds of wonderful, wonderful things that you can purchase. Also available on the e-tailers, there is an introduction on the Starfleet Universe Prime Directive and role-playing there, which is, of course, kind of a Star Trek, you know, but this is in the old Star Trek themes, though it is in the Starfleet universe, so there are some things that are not in the original Star Trek that are part of, you know, the Starfleet universe of ADB. And you can find that, you know, definitely over in Warehouse 23. Actually, I have a link here, but you don't want it. Because of, I'm sure it does not work anymore because of the new shop that Warehouse 23 now uses. But I'm sure they also have it in DriveThruRPG and also War Game Vault. Moving onward and forward to come to the SFB Online Tournament, the Sapphire Star 14 tournament is started. At least it's now open up for accepting signups. The signups, we've got 13 already. There's only three slots left. So sign up before they run out, in which case you will be on the back burner. You know, you might be able, if someone drops out, you might be able to pick up where, you know, their slot. But other than that, I would say, after the three slots are left, are filled up, nothing, you ain't got nothing. Moving on and forward, there's nothing happening on the online client these days. It's been kind of quiet. I know what I want to work on, but I have to find the time to actually sit down and do it. When it comes to library port, there's nothing happening there, though. There's multiple SSDs that I need to work on updating onto the SFB library, and of course there's the gunboats, which I still haven't gotten to, and I apologize for that. And with that, that is the news for this week. And it's me, it's the one Paul, for welcoming you to Star from the Universe On Call. And tonight, well, we have Doug. How you doing, Doug?
Hi. I'm here.
That's good to hear. And we have Jeff. How you doing, Jeff?
Good evening.
Good evening. Whoop. And turned off my volume on my iPad that I use for my monitor.
Sorry about that.
That's fine. Okay. Everything is rock and rolling. The topic for this evening actually is kind of continuing forward on the topic from last week, which we discussed Stellatorian and Eternal Cruiser and the possibility of improving it so it's more of a viable ship. We're going to move on to the Romulan Tournament King Eagle, which is an interesting ship by itself. It has been improved over the years to make it more viable, more has a better chance of at least winning a game, if not as much winning a tournament, because obviously, like any other ship, in this case, plasma ship, if you have a lot of ships that can fight well against plasma ships, then it probably it's not going to do that well. But of course, if you have a mixture, then you got a chance. But here's the problem. As everyone and anyone who actually has ever played or even looked at that ship, it's internal wise, it reminds you kind of either an Andromedan or a Orion. That is, it doesn't have that much internal padding and so forth. And of course, one of the big issues, you know, obviously it's got the R, which is like, everyone looks at the R and kind of drools. But of course, the problem with the R, well, hey, come on. If you hit with 100 point EPT plasma, it's going to hurt. But that's a big freaking if.
Yeah, because weasels exist, and the thing is, in order to get the 100 points of warhead, you've got to just be prepared to strip all of their shields.
Right, and of course, what's the big issue? What was another big issue with the enveloper? It costs 10 points of energy for one turn. Huh. So that's
it's a biggin.
Oh, that's a biggin. That's a biggin. That's obviously it's a little more than a quarter of the power that's available on the ship just to fire one weapon. And of course, if you fire it and they while weasel it, okay, there's a it's down the tubes.
Yeah, three more. That's gonna be three turns. Get so many impulses cloaked.
Yeah.
In the tournament these days.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And at the moment, the only ship that would even possibly you would do it against at the beginning part of the game would be like the Andromedan, who cannot actually wild weasel. So.
No, but he can outrun your
fork. Right. Oh, agreed. Oh, I totally agree with that. I'm just saying that's the only one that would be viable to do that with, unless you really want to scare someone. And just like any other plasma, what's one of the things that you do with the plasma? The reason why you launch your plasma is not to hit the other opponent's ship, but as mobile terrain, which meaning that you are launching it to have your opponent do go away, you know, turn away from you. Because one, he knows it's real.
Control the battlefield.
Right. Mm-hmm. And
so, yeah, it's a deterrent.
Right, it's a deterrent. So your opponent's either gonna do one of two things. They're either going to turn and run away, or they're going to stop. Yay! They stopped. And wild weasel. In which case, you've got speed on them at that point. So that's what you use for plasma for. Now, of course, there one of the big issues with the TKE, you know, Terminal King Eagle, is that it's only got three torps, two Fs and one R, compared to the other plasma torpedo ships, which have two S's and two F's. You know, I'm talking about the normal ones. I'm excluding ISC from this equation at the moment. That's a special ship, because it has that PBD. But you know, which of course that means that those ships, the ones with the two S's and two F's, have greater flexibility. You know, they have the ability. Those ships actually have the ability to have a relatively large torpedo, in this case, the 30-point torpedo, launching. It doesn't have to be every three turns, so it can be almost every two turns. You know, as you roll them from one to the other. You know, there's going to be a time when you won't have either S's, yes, but you'll have next turn you'll have another S. So there's always going to be a deterrent, because a 30-point torpedo can knock down a shield. Versus, you know...
Let me ask a couple questions.
Go ahead.
The first question is... I forgot. I'm sorry. One of the issues that I have with... Oh, I remember the question now. Did they put in, or did they just talk about putting in a rule about how much you can cloak?
My understanding is that according to the latest edition of Module T, you have a total of 128 impulses under cloak, after which point the cloaking device fails and cannot be repaired.
Okay.
I think there's another rule that says that if both tournament ships have a cloaking device, that the two ships together can't remain cloaked on the board at the same time for more than 32 impulses. I think.
Oh, wow.
But this is from memory, so I'd have to go digging to make certain.
Yeah, I would.
But I'm pretty sure the 128 impulse limit is in the book.
Okay. Well, the reason I was wondering about that is because one of the issues that I see with this is that the tournament itself was kind of built around what the battle cruisers or the heavy cruisers,
right?
And it's kind of an oddball ship that they had to change and beef up a bit and do extra special funky stuff with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I agree with you. It's just one of those kind of, it's like you shoehorn something in. And then you wonder, why doesn't it work as well as everything else? Well, everything else is kind of originally the thing that this was coming in for, the tournament setup. And if you have those limitations on cloaking, that's going to hurt it a lot because, you know, outside of a tournament, that particular class of ship, you really have to cloak a lot and take multiple shots at your opponent. Unless you can anchor them. and get that really good kill in.
Part of the reason I think they limit the cloaking device the way they do is the fact that short of the plus two shift, if you've got an active undestroyed weasel on the board, you don't get to do anything with electronic warfare. And because of that, there's very few ways you can actually improve your chances to maintain or regain a lock-on after somebody cloaks. I think it was just a simplification of the system. Now, this brings up another issue, and that is that the original is that the Romulans in a very interesting position. Of all the empires the tournament represents, they're the only one that gets three bites at the apple. You've got the King Ingle, you've got the Klingon Hall, and you've got the Firehawk, even if the Firehawk is or isn't in the current mix-up. It's there historically, if nothing else.
True. Oh, just one quick thing on the cloaking. Well, Chris Nuzzi posted what the rule is, and it's only for cloak versus cloak, as in two ships that both of them, in those battles which both ships have cloaking devices, no ship can remain cloaked for more than 120 impulses total for the entire battle. That's only for cloak v cloak.
I knew there was some rules for that. I wasn't entirely sure that's the way that was, but yeah. I remember reading that at one point.
Yeah, I thought that was the case, but you know, I wasn't 100% sure, so I wasn't about to disagree with you when I didn't know the rule by heart, because it's been many years since I've read the tournament rule book on said fact. I agree that the King Eagle was kind of shoehorned into the tournament. The idea is to allow you that third option for the Romulans, and I understand the Romulans probably don't even need it. But
it's also the only way to get an R-Torp in the tournament.
That is true. I can't imagine a Gorn ship having an R-Torp. That would be...
Well, I mean, that's why they call it an R-Torp. It's the Romulan torpedo versus the Gorn torpedo, which is why one's an R and one's a G.
I know. I understand. If you go back,
and then the F torpedo is for the freezer box. You stick the thing in once you get done loading it.
Right. I'm thinking about back to the original rule book. Yeah, which was an interesting Starfleet battles back then was definitely a different beast. You know.
Yep.
But getting back to it, because the question in the case of the Terminal King Eagle, when it comes to the torp situation, I'm just going to focus on the torp situation for the moment, is whether the three torps can be made to work, or does it need a fourth torp? You know, does it need to be like every other plasma ship in the tournament? I'd hope that the answer is no. You can make three torps work. Would be my hope. Because of it's unique, you know, and I think it's not, especially given, I was going to say that the King Eagle has the best cloak cost of any of the Romulan ships, but I don't
pull it up, take a look at it.
Yeah, that's a
mm-hmm. Let's not, you know, when we've got a reference handy, let's look at the reference.
Yeah, okay. I can bring up. Okay. Bring it up. Da-da-da, come on. Oh, there it is. Okay. Da-da-da-da-da. There it is. Okay. Here. Hopefully I got that right. Got it at least up on my screen. And The cloaking cost for it is 15.
Yeah, I think the Orion 20.
The Firehawk is 18, and the KR is 20.
Okay, maybe it's 22 on the Orion.
That doesn't.
I just know if there is the CR the Orion TCR has a cloak. It's the MR that doesn't. Or do I have that backwards?
I think you have it backwards because the BR has a cloak. I think the CA doesn't have a cloak.
Okay.
And the Orion is the cloaking cost is 12 for the Battle Raider. Now, of course, that's assumed that you don't have your engines doubled, because I'm pretty sure the cloak cost doubles if you double your engines.
If you double anything, the cloak cost doubles. Yeah.
So it's got the best cloaking cost of any of the ships, which is good. And obviously, one of the wonderful things about the Terminal King of Eagle is, of course, the 10 points of armor, which is more armor than the normal King Eagle has. The idea is to beef up, you know, the structurally internals for it.
The other interesting thing about it is, I think the hidden, if you play it right, I think the hidden strength in that, I'd have to go digging, but isn't there a weird interaction with armor and an armor belt and continuous damage repair that you can use one of your repairs to repair the armor belt, and you can keep repairing boxes as long as they're in the same group?
No, if I recall correctly, the armor is one of those things that cannot be repaired by CDR.
I guess I'm thinking hull. There was one situation where you could, for the cost of one repair, you could repair a whole bunch of boxes on your SSD. I thought it was armor. It must be hull.
Yeah.
And it might not be in the tournament that way though.
Right. Right. Yeah, but there's no special rules for when it comes to repair itself. You know, you can repair anything using CDR that is available to repair. There's nothing that you can't repair. Usually, the only reason you don't repair certain systems is because they're too darn expensive to repair those systems. But yeah, I know you can repair hull because I've done that myself with the Andromeda, because of course the leak points. And protect getting those internals. And if I recall correctly, the hull takes 2 points of repair to repair hull.
Yeah, I'm not where I can pull it up at the moment, but there's just a little tickle in the back of my mind that there was one trick system that it didn't count against. If as long as the boxes were all together.
Right. I think you're thinking about the Andromedan and degradation.
I'll have to go looking for that when I can stop and pull up the NBR, because then again, there have been a few adjustments to rules since I was first playing back in the early days of Captain's Edition.
Oh, understood. Now, of course, what are the biggest issues with the King Eagle? Obviously, you got the problem is you have 3 torps versus 4 torps. The other one, of course, is the turn mode. Another one, in my mind anyway, is internals, though, looking at it, doesn't look that as bad as I had expected because, of course, you have the armor. And the armor makes up for certain things. And actually, the armor is kind of unique in just not just the tournament, but in play in general. And that is that after you, it's one of those systems that even though you got shield down, it still won't do quote unquote internals. You know, i.e., you know, on like weapons hits and things like that. You still have to get through the armor before you actually can start rolling for damage. Now, you know, when it comes to Hellebores, you know, that it's the Hellebore can still damage the armor, but you know, so in that case, the reason why if you have a shield down in the case of a Hellebore, then you have, you know, issues where most of the damage get hit on that, come through that one shield. So that being the case, you know, if we included the 10 armor into the hull, then it would have 16 hull, which is not bad at all when it comes to hull. Because let me do one quick check here. For let's just count the hull for, let's say, the Firehawk. The Firehawk has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's 8 rear hull and 3 forward hull. So overall, the King Eagle actually has more hull than the tournament. Now, of course, I think it's possible that part of the issue might be just the weapons involved. That is, it has, you know, it has those 3 torpedoes, the 2 Fs and 1 R, and then it has the 4 phaser 1s, and then it has the 6 phaser 3s. The 6 phaser 3s have kind of weird arcs, but that's understandable. You've got 4 of them, which are basically rear arc. The whole idea of that is just drone defense.
You know?
And then you have the 2, which is 1 right side, 1 left side, which is okay. When it comes to number of phasers, you know, that it's around this, if I call it correctly, that's around the same as the Zinni. But of course, the Zinni has a lot more phaser 3s than the King Eagle.
What do they have? What, 8 threes?
Yeah.
So that's just 2 more. So you've got a phaser cap of what, 7? 4 ones and 4 ones and 6 threes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so at that point, you've got a reasonably sized phaser capacitor with only 4 secondaries on the offensive side. You've got a lot of chasing your tailpipe drone defense. But short of bolting your torps or getting lucky with the R, it doesn't show the same threat as the Firehawk, who has 1 more phaser 1 if memory serves.
Mm-hmm.
Or the phaser secondaries available on the KR. Because I think the KR has even more phasers than the Firehawk, even if most of them are phaser 2s in the secondary hull.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it shouldn't have phaser 2s. The phaser 2s get, for the KR, gets converted to phaser 3s.
Okay, so it's got what? The KR has what? 5 phaser 1s and a whole bunch of 3s?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Has 6 phaser 3s and 5 phaser 1s.
Okay, so... So if you want to look at it that way, between the Firehawk and the KR, you've got an extra heavy weapon, an extra heavy weapon box on the SSD, an extra heavy, extra offensive phaser. It just does seem like it's a little on the light side,
mm-hmm.
And it's all about the fact that the King Eagle is one of those weird in-between designs. It's not a cruiser. It's not a destroyer. It's not even a light cruiser. It's something entirely different.
Agreed. Agreed. And yes, it has some, one of the things that is unique to it is the T-bomb, you know, which replaces a nuclear space mine, which actually brings up something which I've always thought, and I would totally love to see it experimented upon, which is just make sure, you know, have it so that the, okay, let me just go forward and then I'll do the caveats, which is swap out the T-bomb, which can only be rolled out. It can't be transported, which is, I think, sucks. Give it its old nuclear space mine. Give it back to it. You want to talk about really scaring people? That's one way to do it. And yeah, and in that case, put it with the caveat that it can't be hidden, because that then becomes just freaking ridiculous. Because I think having a hidden mine in the tournament would just be insane.
I remember that option was discussed in a captain's log years and years ago, and the torches and pitchforks crowd was not thrilled with the concept of having to play against a cloaked King Eagle, where you know where he is, you know his hex trail, but you've got to keep up with where his hex trail is, because he could roll that thing out without anybody knowing anything until he says, well, you just rolled into hex 1707 and a nuclear space mine is in 1706, and boom.
There goes your shield.
Yeah, and then some, because there's short of the Andromedan, there's nobody in the tournament that can bounce an NSM.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Which brings up, so as I said, you know, okay, bring it back to NSM and don't have it so it's not hidden. But you know, obviously, it would definitely, people would approach attacking the King Eagle with a lot more caution. If the Dromedan King Eagle gets cloaked and you try to chase it, having that nuclear space mine that it could just roll out, and then after it's one, you know, two hexes distant, it activates. Then you're gonna be a little more cautious about how you approach it, or you know, have it so that the T-bomb actually can be hidden. Because come on, it's a T-bomb. It's 10 points of damage. It's not going to drop your shield. Now, if you have a down shield to begin with, then you're gonna be a little more cautious about following them, which I think tactically makes a big difference. Because if people are more hesitant to attack King Eagle, in that situation, or you know, chase the King Eagle, whether it's cloaked or not cloaked, then you know, you're going to give it a little more room. Now, obviously, there's the big issue, which is, even if it has, you know, if you're allowed to do that, the one thing that I can easily see, you know, happening, which is after it uses it, it's out there, and no longer has the King Eagle no longer has that deterrent. You know,
it's like the pseudoplasma torpedoes. Once gone, they're gone.
Yep.
It does remind me of another Romulan tactic that was all the fashion for a while. First impulse of decloaking, first impulse after you turn the cloak off, you pop a weasel.
Right.
When you're fully visible, you do an alpha launch on your plasma, because that happens in the order of sequence above shuttle operations, and then you pop a second weasel before you start cloaking again.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's you can do that. Of course, the thing is, you just used two of the four wild weasels that you have.
Yeah.
So you can't do that too often. In that case, your opponent, to counteract that, they just have to use one wild weasel and they're done. Especially if you're going to be cloaked, you know.
It's one of those weird things that articles got written about years ago, and it's one of those fashionable things to do. It's like okay, well, I'm going to start coming out of cloak. You've got a lock on, but you've got to add four hexes of range and a +2 shift. It's just one of the very oddities of the last remnants of electronic warfare that was in the tournament.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, actually, remember, to use the Wild Weasel in either one of those instances, you have to be moving speed 4 or less.
Which, if you're fighting a heavy plasma race and you've just finished loading all of your torpedoes, you probably already are if you paid for cloaking to begin with.
Oh, agreed. But the big point there is that you have to be going slow, which means you're not going to be very maneuverable, versus you're forced to be that slow, versus you can, coming out of cloak, you can be faster, let's say speed 15, and then delay a decrease in speed later on, so you have the power for the plasmas that you're going to be launching.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that being the case there. So, you know, the King Eagle, obviously the one thing that you can possibly do is swap out those phaser, the two phaser threes, on, because I don't think changing the rear phaser threes to anything really will do anything. And I think, looking more on it, I think when it comes to the number of internals, it's got enough internals. And I don't think, obviously one thing would be really nice if you could change the turn mode, but I don't think that's possible, because it's just, it is what it is in that case, because of, it is an old, you know, Raman, an old ship. And so that was the way that it was a very not very maneuverable ship, so that's not going to change. So the two things I can think of to make it more of a threat is to actually to upgrade the two phaser threes that are on left side, right side, the phaser ones, and since they're left side, right side, unless you got someone's center line, you're only going to be firing fire phaser ones anyway. You know, so to me, it's not going to be a really big help. I don't think it would be overly damaging. You know, what am I thinking about? It would not wreck the balance of the ship. Unlike adding two phaser ones to the Seltorian. I'm just saying.
Yeah, well.
Trust me. Hey, if they want to put that, give the Seltorian two phaser ones back, I'm up for it.
About to say, yeah, that sounds more like wishful thinking on your part.
Oh, I know it's wishful thinking at this point, because after that happened that one time, Steve Petrick will never, ever let that happen again. Because I still remember, I was there when he made that decision. When they said, oh, the Saturn needs the two-phase ones, and he went with the crowd who said, yeah, we need two-phase ones. So he added it without testing it as the, not a playtest ship, as the blessed ship for tournaments. And I remember fighting against the 10 phaser Saturni in the Andromedan back in the day when the Andromedan was a lot more powerful than it is today. And it got killed because of those phasers. You know?
Yep.
Because it, you know, forget the particle cannons. Use the phasers and use it as a fast cruiser.
Oh, yeah.
Which is always an interesting idea with the Saltorian. Make it into a fast cruiser. Remove two of the particle cannons and replace two of the particle cannons with two phasers. You know? It would be interesting to see how that would work out. Because the thing is, as I said, the original change was just to add two phaser ones, not swap out two particle cannons for two phaser ones, but just add. Because the biggest issue there with doing that is that you still had the particle cannons for it cost you a big whopping 6 points of energy to have enough energy for the first battle pass to have overloaded particle cannons. And after the first battle pass, after you got that first punch, you don't charge them anymore. And then focus on the phasers. So, but that makes that first punch, that, you know, easily can be an additional 8 points of damage for that first punch. And then, of course, you still have lots of energy, and you can, and since it doesn't require any energy to hold the weapon, and more to the point, you no longer have to charge the weapon, in this case the particle cannons, you're much better off, which is another reason why they probably would never agree to having converting the Saltorian to a fast cruiser, where you only had two particle cannons. But I'll admit that would be interesting. I think that would be interesting to playtest, to see how well that would actually work. I probably want to play it against plasma, because definitely I can see the additional phasers being an excellent thing against drones.
Oh yeah, more phasers would always chew up the drones.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But anyway, yeah, and I think adding, you know, either make the T-bomb hidden, I think would be a great idea. And as I said, I don't think a hidden T-bomb, which is only 10 points of you know, damage, would be, you know, I think unviable. You know, to make the King Eagle too strong, I don't think so. Because the biggest issue with mines as it stands, because of your laying it, you can't even transport it. You've got to drop it out the hatch. That's the only way you can use the T-bomb, because it's a replacement for the NSM.
And do you have to drop it out the hatch, you have to leave its effective zone before it arms.
Exactly. Which is why I think having the T-bomb hidden would be a good thing. It definitely would, as I said, it would, at least until the T-bomb was actually used up, would definitely make the people who are fighting against the King Eagle more cautious about where they're going. So I think it'd be worth playtesting to see how it all worked out with those two changes.
That would be interesting.
because, you know, personally, I'd like to have the NSM back. With the caveat.
Come to think of it, when they first brought the tournament King Eagle in, it didn't have 10 boxes of armor. It only had 5.
That's correct.
And it had the NSM originally. I think the extra 5 boxes of armor was kind of to soften the blow of dropping the NSM to a T-bomb.
No, I don't think that. No, I'm pretty sure that was not the case. I think they dropped the NSM to a T-bomb before they added the additional 5 armor.
Okay.
Now it's been a while. The question is, do I have module 2000 and the tournament module before that? Because what was it? It was in the 90s when they first published the module T.
Yeah, the original module T. I think the first one is 95 or 94. And it was a staple in the center booklet rather than the perfect bound stuff that mm-hmm. Captain's Log usually was, because it wasn't so many pages.
Right. Yeah, before they added like tactics articles and the different games and different scenarios you could play, you know, as part of it. Okay. Chris Newsy is stating that there is no NSM in the 93 KE SSD and only 5 armor. So it never had the NSM. Probably because it scared the crap out of people. But
the thing is that the King Eagle about the only weapon it has is intimidation, because people see that 50-point warhead drop on the map or that 35-point NSM. I'm not talking the tournament. I'm talking standard Starfleet battles.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that intimidation factor definitely changes how people approach the ship outside the tournament.
Oh, yeah.
And I think they were trying to bring some of that flavor into the tournament without bringing in all of the other aspects of a long Romulan cloak hunt.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got an adequately competent Romulan piloting, going up and down for cloaked, you've got a long sub hunt scenario ahead of you.
Yeah, but that's why when we have the issue of non-engagement, and you know, and we had that rule added because of people, because you get these people. I still remember this. That you get these people who would do really well, like the first battle pass, they'd be really far ahead.
And then they drag their heels and delay to try to run the time out.
Right, exactly.
Try to run the clock out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, they basically start castle and do a very, very defensive game after that. It's like, no. And that's why they came up with the rules on non-engagement. You know,
yeah.
They said, no, you can't do this. And we'll give you a warning after the first turn. And now, you know, I know some players complain about it. Like, well, it's a valid tactic. Yeah, it's a valid tactic. But at the same time, If you're planning completely to play a defensive game after you got ahead, you know,
the thing is, the way I always looked at it was like this: is that you are correct. It is a valid tactic. You're ahead on points. You're going to defend your lead in a way that you think is tactically appropriate. However, at the other side of the equation, what you're really doing is that you're strangling the entertainment value for the people who might be watching, and the person on the other side of the table who is looking at the way you're handling things and going, you're denying me an opportunity to make a comeback. And the thing is, part of the thing is that with any type of war game, if you turn around and you beat up on the new people and do things like this, they're not going to hang around because playing a round of Starfleet battles is a significant investment of time.
Yep.
And if you make it unfun, people will do something else.
Exactly. And that was the issue. It made it a very boring game. And to be honest, I'm sorry. If you're really ahead after the first battle pass, you know, and you're not giving your opponent the opportunity to come back, what's the point of playing anymore? You know? As I said, it's not fun at all.
I mean,
Chris Newsy, go
ahead.
All I was going to mention is Chris Newsy wrote something which I don't think is viable whatsoever. And even, that's not, I think that's even the case with the Federation Commander tournament. It wasn't quite, and that's why it came up with certain specialized rules when we tried to do the online edition. And Chris was saying that basically that he thinks there shouldn't be any tournament ships, any tweaks that's for the tournament ships, and they should use the real ships. Now, in theory, you could do that. What's the one thing that you'd have to do? Something which would be a pain, which is get rid of the if you use real ships, you got to get rid of the tournament barrier. There's no longer, okay, this is a fixed board. This board is floating. So it changes that aspect of the game completely. Now, of course, the biggest issue there then becomes of an issue of time. That's one of the reasons why you play in the fishbowl, is that you need to have it so that it's not going to take you 6 hours to play one game. And so flying in the fishbowl, it forces you to engage your opponent because there's only so far you can run away from your opponent.
That's right.
Versus a floating map where you can, your opponent can be chasing you and you just keep on running. Now
you got if you're on a floating map and you're ahead of him and he doesn't have the ability to overtake you, there's no point in charging your weapons. Just run the warp engines to the red line and zoom on out. You got to have a reason to stay in a box.
Chris, the only reason people play real SFB on a fixed map is because there is something to force you to be on that fixed map. Usually is a point of defense.
Something to defend, yeah.
Yep, pointing somebody to defend.
Something to keep you in the box.
Right. If it's a fleet battle, you're not playing on a fixed map. On a fixed map, unless it's a scenario rules stated, in which case, what happens when you leave the map? Then it's considered disengagement at that point. And that's usually because it's a fixed point in space because of that, what the scenario says about that fixed point in space. You know? So that's one of the things I don't think will ever occur. And that's why we have it so that the tournament ships actually have been tweaked. It's because of we're fighting the fishbowl, so there's certain changes, changes in the rules that are used or changes in the ships themselves to make it so it's a viable ship in that environment. And then what Chris says that he never uses a fixed map. So obviously, Chris, you play a lot of fleet battles which has floating maps, which I when it comes to combat in space makes perfect sense, except for in the case where, you know, as we pointed out, you're defending a fixed point, which like a planet and so forth. That's usually your fixed point as a planet or a base, you know. something that cannot move. But anyway, so, because when it comes, can I get back to King Eagle? The King Eagle, the cloak cost is not that bad. It's 15. You know, the difficulty part, which is purely tactical, is the three plasma issue, which I don't think you can solve. That's going to be a tactical problem that needs to be solved, and it's a tactical problem that can't be solved by changing the ship. Well, in theory, you can change the ship and solve it. Just replace the R with two S's, you know, and that solves the problem. But then it no longer is a King Eagle at that point, you know.
And even if you were to jump the F's up to G's, that changes the dynamic in other ways. There's not a whole lot you really can do with the King Eagle design before you change it away from what the King Eagle is to begin with. And it all comes back to the fact that the King Eagle was originally an odd in-betweener design that was built around it, for lack of a better way of putting it, it was wrapping a ship around a weapon system.
Right.
And there's no other term and option that has that flavor of that vessel's only reason for being is to get that weapon system, that one singular weapon system, to market.
Yeah. True. And if you really think about it, when it comes to the design of the King Eagle, when it comes to the history of the Romulans, originally the King Eagle was the warbird.
Yep.
That's where it started. The warbird is the only thing that moved at warp speed was the weapon itself. The warbird was a sublight ship with a massive weapon that, and the only reason, so it makes things more difficult to fight. You know,
this is especially poignant to consider when you turn around and you look at what the old sublight game rules used to show what combat might have been. If you go on the website and you go looking at player resources, the old sublight rules are posted for you to download and take a look at. Now, this is pre-Commander's Edition. But the original sublight rules, if you take the warbird and you plug it into that sublight system, it changes so much that ship becomes almost an unbeatable monster inside that fishbowl, inside that environment. But if you take that warbird and you put it on a tactical map with a empire with warp technology, it's meat on the table. It's hard to compete. It all comes back to the fact that the Romulans didn't get tactical warp technology until very late in the game, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. In which case, you know, before then, you know, before it actually got tactical warp power, I mean, if their opponents had tactical warp, that means that their ships became a purely defensive ship because of their weapons could match the speed of the enemy ships. It's just that you didn't have much maneuverability compared to their ships.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just bringing it up, which is interesting, because the interesting part about this is that they have SSDs, like a Federation sublight heavy cruiser, which is interesting. It's got four missiles, two batteries, it's got eight labs, It's got six lasers. Remember, lasers, not phasers, lasers. Which is it's a hit or miss weapon, which is
sharks not included.
Yep. The original design for the SMB.
And if you look at the old way of doing things, in the sublight game, missiles, the drones of the day, are one a lot scarier and a lot more survivable, because lasers are almost never a surefire option.
Right, right. That's very true. Yeah, because
and
even at range one, you've got a 1 in 5 to hit.
Yeah.
And how much? Okay. Atomic missiles have a speed of 12. They move 2 hexes per impulse. Because in the sublight game, you only have 6 impulses.
Right.
And they have endurance of 3 turns. They are seeking weapons, follow their targets. Atomic missiles do 4 points of damage if they hit. And they're destroyed by the flight. Atomic missile in flight are destroyed by 1 point of damage and can also be destroyed by another missile. So each ship carries 8 reload missiles for each rack, which can be reloaded onto any rack. 1 or 2 missiles can be reloaded onto any rack during one turn, but the rack cannot be fired during the turn it's being reloaded.
Yeah. So, and the thing is, there's no defensive laser. A laser is a laser is a laser. So you have to forego shooting that laser at the other guy that turn in order to possibly shoot down that missile coming at you. It gives an answer to why the Zenti were so potent in earlier years, because the missile technology they developed that became drones was just a huge force projection for them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, agreed. Wow, this is from the Commander's Rulebook, Volume 1, 1983.
Yeah.
Wow. Holy cow, this is old. Let me look at that. I'm sorry. I'm good. The Raman Sublight Snipe S Frigate, which has 6 impulse, 2 lasers and 2 missiles, and 3 armor, and like 3 hull, 1 shuttle, 1 APR, and 3 batteries, and 1 bridge.
Yeah, those old ships were probably the easiest to end up becoming uncontrolled. With only one command space, you don't have to drill too deep into the deck to hit it and knock it out.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And that ship, man, all you need is roll a 2, boom, that's it. And actually, let me look at something.
Yeah, you pretty much.
Oh, freaking hell.
You pretty much just. Yeah.
The only thing I'm noticing about these ships, they don't have shields.
Nope.
Wow, you want to talk about a challenge? Ho, 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 ho.
That's why the original Sombrero class Federation heavy cruiser, I say Sombrero class, I mean the traditional saucer and booms, or saucer and nacelles shape, was so earth changing in that era is that it got 5-box shields. It was the first ship to have 5-box shields all the way around.
Wow.
And that's a game changer when all you do is have lasers popping back and forth at each other.
Right, right. Yep, you're right. I'm looking at the sublight heavy cruiser. It has 5 box shields. Dang, got it, man.
So, when do you want to try to put the skull sweat together to come up with an early years tournament?
Yeah, that.
Can you imagine a YTCA, a Federation YTCA?
Yeah. No.
I can hear the groaning from Amarillo right now.
Oh, agreed. Wow. Gotta say the one thing about the sublights is just that it's an interesting take. You know, because the whole idea before we had all. Yeah. Chris, Andy Palmer is another person who loved the early years. He loved the idea. One thing he loved about the early years is the whole idea of that you would, that, you know, Speed 8 drones, actually, you had to fear them because of the Zinni could either walk or chew gum, but it couldn't do the same at both time. And with a good, you know, it got the timing right. The Zinni was a formidable opponent, you know, with Speed 8 drones, which was crazy.
Yeah, the old Zinni anchor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course, you actually spoken to Andy.
Yeah,
wow.
Zinni anchor was feared. Awesome.
Because I haven't spoken to Andy in years. I know the last time I heard from him, he was still living, I think, in Columbia, Maryland. But this was many, many years ago when I was still running tournaments down in Balticon, which was, I enjoyed doing Balticon. Is that the thing with Balticon is that it's a sci-fi convention, which happened to have a room for people to play games. So I was there for.
Reminds me of RockCon back in the day.
Yeah, I went for many, many years. I went to one Balticon, and there was at one point there was nobody showed up, you know, and I kept coming. I think maybe. For one more year, and that was it. And I gave up. At that point, I stopped coming. Stopped going. Wow, never thought about that. Chris was just mentioning the SFU history is interesting because the drone tech lagged behind the engine tech. Oh, that's definitely an interesting thought.
It's one of the odd dichotomies. You've got the Gorn and the Romulan that have speed 32 weapons when everybody else's seeking weapons were down at speed 8.
Right.
And then by the time you got to the point where you hit the start of the General War, most of the empires have a battle speed 20 or 24 cruisers, and speed 20 drones are commonplace, but speed 32 are not.
Right. That didn't come until like what was it? It became common like Y-184.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
So, yeah. Anyhow, I think with that we will wrap it up for this evening. Did not mean to get into discussion of light speed. Sublight ships, which are definitely interesting thing. Definitely, I don't think anyone, if you ever would put them up, and people, I don't think would really recognize them. They'd recognize that. Oh, yeah, that kind of looks like a SFB ship, you know, a Star Trek ship, but yeah, it doesn't quite match. Well, what you know what they look like. So, anyhow, Jeff, it's been awesome talking to you. You have a good night.
I'll do that. Be safe, everybody.
You too. Doug, you still there? Okay, I don't hear you. I might have lost Doug along the way. I will just, at this moment, just mute that because I think I lost Doug somewhere. And if he texts me, I won't even see it. But anyhow, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.